This is Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 2, Thursday, April 24, 1969, 1 p.m., Room 401, Capitol Building. Today's subject, Kidnapping and Related Offenses, Preliminary Draft Number 4, Sexual Offenses, Preliminary Draft Number 1.
To stay with 2 degrees of kidnapping. And make them more aggravated ones, the hostage or shield cases, or where their ransom is demanded, or to cause serious physical injury. This really, the thrust of the thing hasn't changed that much. It's really a matter of structure more than anything, trying to get away from some of these definitions that, for one thing, you know, we had the definition of restraint. We said the definition of restraint was such and such, and then to get into kidnapping, you got into the term abduct, which incorporated the definition of restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the approach that New York takes and that Michigan takes, but it is a little awkward, I suppose, in that you incorporate by reference this other definition. But if you look at number 3, let's see, it's under a green tab. That's your third green tab in your book. Preliminary draft number 3. You can see the definition of restrain and abduct. Well, abduct then means to restrain a person with the intent to prevent his liberation, and then talks about secreting or holding him, using or threatening to use deadly physical force. Well, that same concept I think I've kept in number 4, my basic definition of kidnapping in the second degree, because the elements there are, first, an intent to interfere substantially with another's personal liberty. Well, that's the same language that appeared in the definition of restraint. And then takes the person from one place to another or secretly confines a person. That's language is comparable, at any rate, to language that appeared in the definition of abduct. So the same rationale, I think, is in there, except that I've eliminated those two definitions and just stated them as elements of the crime. I think that might answer the objection that we had to the previous draft.
I had noted on here affirmative defense. That bothered me. What? Avoid affirmative defense. You should take a greater notes. I don't remember what that.
What was that?
Avoid affirmative defense. I think where we ran into most of our trouble, I thought, was back in the other, when we get back into the more refined custodial interference.
Well, we had some problems there too, yeah, and I've changed that. I ought to mention to you, I think, too, now under kidnapping the first degree, one of the things that there are two words we used in there that were discussed. One was the word hostage. Judge Burns felt that hostage and also terrorized should be defined.
Terrorized,
well, I don't think
bad.
They should be.
Hold a victim as a shield or hostage. I don't think we need to define hostage.
But I put in the commentary what we mean by both of those words, hostage and terrorize, and they both have precise dictionary definitions.
Do we use terrorize? Wasn't it, my feeling was that the concern, the hostage, I think I disagreed with the concern that registered that time. I think hostage is easily identifiable. I think we all know what we mean by
hostage.
And
it's used in our present statute.
Right.
We've
but,
never
but
seen that in
to
trouble.
Terrorize is such a colorful word, such a illiterate word. You know, not illiterate, but literate. It's frighten or excite or something like this. But terrorize, to me, for instance, a person commits a crime. If he violates Section 2 of this article with any of the following purposes, so let's say I confine somebody with the intent that he not be found.
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
Or he's not likely to be
found. Not likely to be found, okay. if I add the element to terrorize the victim or another person, how about if I just meant to scare him a little bit?
Well, then I don't think you'd be guilty.
So what you're really saying, terrorize has to be really a malicious, vicious,
extremely frightening experience, that you want to inflict extreme fright, either a fear of torture or starvation or any other number of things. But you see, what we're concerned with, and the way that the draft is worded, is with the with any of the following purposes. So what you intend to do is going to be important. It's going to be crucial. It's not really going to be so much the effect this has on your victim or on another person, but what you intended.
Yeah, but of course, I'm trying to think of it from both from the prosecutor's standpoint and from the defendant's standpoint.
Yeah.
I take somebody up, and to the jury, my intentions are unknown, and I go out and I place them in a cabin. Confinement. Far from the community. Now, how do you measure, to that point I've committed kidnapping to the second degree. Mm-hmm. And of course if I hold them for a shield or hostage or to do physical injury or to compel payment, which is the normal one we mostly frequently think of.
Yeah.
I buy that. Okay, but to terrorize, how does it district attorney prove what my intent was? All right, if I admit that my intent was to terrorize, but most people wouldn't say that. They'd say, well, I just want to scare them.
Sure. Yeah, and it's going to be a question of fact, and a lot of things would enter into it, I suppose. The age of the victim, or whether there's any other motivation that comes in, any motive that you might have for doing this, whether it's you're doing this to terrorize, maybe not the victim, but the parent, one of the parents. You've got a grudge against them or something. And all these things have to be considered. But now the Model Penal Code very carefully chose that word, I think, and in their commentary they point out the kind of cases they were thinking of. And I mentioned here that they said the term was employed to cover vengeful or sadistic abductions. Abductions that were accompanied by threats of torture or death. You know, I mean, if there's evidence to show that you told the victim, I'm going to take you out there and I'm going to leave you to starve to death, or I'm going to tie you up and let the wolves get you, something like that, then that'd certainly be evidence tending
well,
to show
yeah.
what your intent was.
Okay, I was going to say, but my intent really was not that. I have a defense. I'm assuming I get a jury to believe it. But
yeah, if the jury would believe what you say.
It's not what ultimately happens to the victim as it is.
Yeah, and of course, like any other case where you're trying to prove intent, the best question or the best evidence on intent is what you did. You know, you're not usually going to have any subjective
Correct.
Way of telling it. But they, now of course, the dictionary defines it as to impress with terror, to coerce by intimidation, and then terror itself is defined as the state or instance of extreme fear, violent dread, or fright. I think that the commentary tries to clarify that and to indicate that we're not talking about scaring somebody or just scaring them a little or making them upset, but really that the word terrorize, and if we're going to define it, I don't know how we would improve upon the dictionary definition, really. And if we can improve upon it, then as a drafting question, I don't think it ought to be defined.
What happens if I... maybe this never happens. If I secret somebody in the cabin to compel another person to do an act,
well,
that would only be kidnapping in the second degree, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be kidnapping in the second degree. And
those are our fact situation.
Yeah, and of course. This is another thing we've got to discuss with respect to this, although the section isn't in here. Remember, on assault, we had a section on coercion. And at the time that was in there, we deleted it from the assault draft. And there was some discussion. Remember, Bob Clinton said that he wanted to look into it further. Remember that? And he was going to give us a report on the need for it. But the Model Penal Code places coercion in their kidnapping section. And it seems to me that we might want to do something. something like that with this, to add a section on coercion. So although it's a practical matter, it probably wouldn't make any difference whether you charged the guy who did what you indicated with kidnapping in the second degree or with coercion. It probably wouldn't make that much difference. But the purpose of compelling somebody to do something against their will would not fall into the definition of first degree.
How about the fellow gives a note to the bank manager that his family has been kidnapped and or they in fact detain the family of the bank president. Would that be ransom? Would we then come under ransom?
Well, I think you possibly could. It would certainly come under robbery. It would come under robbery in the second.
Yeah, but I think we are. I think we don't. We assume psychologically that kidnapping is one of our most severe crimes.
Oh yeah.
Much more so than robbery or burglary.
Well, more so than burglary, but not so much robbery. Particularly getting into the armed robbery kind of situations.
Well, I'm leading the field. Trying to anticipate,
but your hypothetical, I think, could amount to either robbery or to kidnapping. Although I don't know whether kidnapping, as compared to armed robbery, would be considered any more serious or not.
How about kidnapping? Now that is one that is a federal offense.
Yeah, it's
there is a federal statute on kidnapping.
Yeah. And the reason it's federal, of course, is that. The victim has to be taken across state lines.
Or reason to believe that.
There's a presumption after 24 hours that the victim has been removed from the state, written right into the statute. So that's how they get in the case. But I don't know. It seems to me that what we've got here would cover just about every kind of.
Well, let's do battle on it again.
Possibility.
I don't think we can substitute frighten, because that you could almost prove that in any case. I could just see a defendant after being kidnapped 3 children, and it was not his intent to frighten the children. He had to be some sort of non-compos mentis to realize that, not to realize that. So I think hostage can stay and terrorize. Let's tough it out. They think they can come up with a better term than that.
Well, and then with the commentary, I think it makes it clear that we're talking about not just a frightening experience, but a severely frightening experience.
Okay, now, save me some time trying to find. Is Section 3 then first degree substantially? In fact, it is the same as our.
There's no change in the. There's no change in the. Aggravating factors at all. That's on page 5 of the draft.
Okay, well, shall we go back then to what's the changes on section 2 of that?
Well, kidnapping in the second degree, yeah. It really doesn't change the substance any. It's just that I've eliminated those definitions and used some of the language that was previously included in the definition of abduct and restrain, and just
put it right into the crime.
Put it right into the statement of the crime. Yeah. We've got this intent to interfere substantially with another's liberty. Now I've added a word in there, personal liberty, that wasn't there before.
I'm sorry, I remember what this, I think some objection was to this, the phraseology, a person does not commit a crime, and I think that was what it was. It was an intention to make it, and I think you've already done it here. It is a defense to the prosecution, if a restatement. In other words, in the third draft you said, or it was said, a person does not commit a crime under this section, if. And I think that was what my.
It's really more of an exemption, the way it was written.
Yeah, stated as a defense. Yeah, I think that's what it was. Okay.
And then, of course, here now that defense would be limited to a relative, and we've defined the term relative to mean a parent, ancestor, brother, sister, uncle, or aunt. And they first of all, they've got to be a relative, and the person or that's kidnapped has not yet reached his 16th birthday, child, in other words. and then that his sole purpose is a custodial intent. He just wants to get control of this kid. And it isn't, he doesn't have any other motivations, and he's not trying to terrorize anybody. And if all these three things coexist, then he'll have a defense, but a defense only to kidnapping in the second degree. If any of the aggravating factors come in, if he's, any of these other things that we've listed under Section 3, ransom or to hold the victim as a hostage or any of these other things, or to terrorize, and you might run into a situation to terrorize if you've got a husband and wife beef going on, for example. And, so there's a possibility. So if any of those things occur, then that defense isn't going to apply. And
Is that clearly enough stated? If you hadn't said that, I don't know that I would have.
Well,
I mean, I realize we have our.
I think it will be clear with the commentary, and also with the way we've drafted custodial interference. And now in my commentary on page 4, I point out that the purpose of the defense is to exempt from kidnapping the case involving a relative, in most cases probably would be a parent, who takes or confines a child with the sole purpose of assuming control of the child. It is intended to provide a defense to kidnapping in the second degree only, and if any of the aggravating factors delineated in Section 3 were present, the defense would not apply, and the actor would be guilty of first-degree kidnapping. Even without the first-degree kidnapping factors, the relative still might be guilty of custodial interference under the provisions of subsection 1 and section 4 or under section 5. And custodial interference, now, and this one is one I wrestled around with for a long time, and I drafted it. First of all, I tried to just have one degree, but I think you need to separate the parental kind of situations from the others. And
how many states again have something like this? Is it the model code?
Yeah, it's
New York has.
Yeah, most of the states have something that applies to interference with custody. Your federal kidnapping statute doesn't. It specifically excludes parents from kidnapping. But this would change our existing law. Of course, the existing law we have, this taking away a child with the intent to detain, which does cover relatives, really you can get life imprisonment under that statute. So it's, my thinking would be that custodial interference would be a misdemeanor if it's in the second degree. And
only in the first.
Felony in the first, and only for the reason that if you get these situations where a kid's taken out of the state, you may
need the felony to get him back.
Need the felony, but you might not want to charge kidnapping either. But, so, interference in the second degree, he's got to be under subsection 1, that would be committed by a relative. And it's stated separately because I felt this protracted period or the intent to hold the child permanently would provide some protection for a relative and would also keep the minor custodial interference cases, which should be really handled as a contempt of court or something, out of the DA's office. Because most DAs aren't going to fuss with these cases anyway, unless it's something pretty aggravated. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a decree, they're going to say, go see your lawyer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if the kid has been removed from the state, of course, as you know, they may need the DA to get the kid back. But so, if he's a relative of a kid under 16, and he knows or has reason to know that he has no legal right to do so, such as a court order, and he takes, entices, or keeps the person from his lawful custodian, plus he'd have to have the intent to hold him permanently or for a protracted period. So you wouldn't have somebody who has a custody decree and the husband has weekend visitation and he's supposed to bring the child back on Sunday night and then get him back till Wednesday morning or something, so you don't have the mother in on Monday morning wanting a criminal complaint. And then secondly, and here again, this wouldn't apply to relatives. sentence apply to others? For knowing or having reason to know he has the legal right to do so, he just takes the person from his lawful custodian. This would be intended mainly to cover the kind of situations where you would have someone in the custody of an institution or something like that. And then first degree if they take them from the state, or a substantial risk of injury or physical illness. You've got a small child that's under medication or a special formula. And,
yeah, I saw that. Because that kind of bothered me, but I read your commentary.
This is a sticky area, this child custody situation. And obviously the legislature in our existing law looks very unkindly upon child stealing. Because there's very, very little difference between kidnapping in the first, or kidnapping now, and child stealing.
Or custodial interference.
Yeah. So, but if it's really an aggravated case, it can be prosecuted as kidnapping in the first degree. If it's still kidnapping, we've got second degree. And then if it's something less than that, but you need some criminal sanctions, the custodial interference, you'd have a misdemeanor and a penalty to go on to bridge the gap. And then if
why did you pick 16 or 15?
Well, it's fairly arbitrary. Model Penal Code, I think, uses 14. Seems to be, frankly, about as good an age as any. It's about all I can say for
it. Well, it's nice we got to see 15 for statutory rape, 16 for custodial, 17 for juvenile, 18 maybe for vote. We've got to...
Well, no, it's 16 for statutory rape.
Well, it's the same as this. That's right. It's up 16. To your 16. Yeah. If you're 16 in a day,
I think that's right. But that's what this reads too, does it not?
Well.
Yeah, this is a 15-year-old. So is that right?
Yeah, if he's not reached his 16th birthday, right. Mm-hmm. But any of these ages you pick are going to be pretty arbitrary.
Oh, I agree. I just wondered if
well, in child custody cases in Oregon, isn't there a age where the child has a right to choose?
It can be heard on it. Yeah,
just that, be heard.
Of course, now that's 14.
That's 14.
It's
14,
yeah,
actually.
That's 14.
And that may...
Kind of with all these student rights, I don't know whether I want to... Taking your kid to college and he wants to go to Oregon State, he's going to nail you if he's...
The earlier commentary listed some of these other ages were in some of the various states. I'm pretty sure the model penal code now.
Do we? Let me ask this one
14.
From a grammatical standpoint or syntax. Is this the way we normally state? Is this the best way to state age?
Well, I tell you, this manner of stating it was suggested by Judge Sloan at one of the subcommittee meetings. He felt this was a clearer way of stating it.
I know we've had trouble, for instance, on hunting licenses. It says that somebody... until he is 17 or something like that, and some judge in Eastern Oregon has read that as being 17. Until he's 17, you aren't really 17 till the day just before you're 18 or something like that.
Yeah.
No one really can follow it, but it's... And there is still that argument about when do you become 16, the day... of your birthday or the day after your birthday.
Yeah. And Sloan said that, well, as a judge, he felt this would be clear to a judge that if he read the statute and said it's not yet reached his 16th birthday, that we meant that if he's reached his birthday, then it doesn't apply.
Okay, and we say that in that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the model penal code is 14. I think...
Well, I have no objection.
Michigan uses 16. I think New York New York uses 16. The model penal code had an appendix in one of their tentative drafts. And there are about as many different ages as there are states, you know. And But it seems that, now Illinois uses 13. Just notice that.
Well, why don't we just take a straw vote and everybody put in their preference and we'll take an average. 16 and 2/3 birthday. Let's leave it at 16, that's fine. Now how about, let's go back to the definitions. Could you take the left first and why that?
All right, now we had a lot of talk about that on this question of what we were talking about without consent under the previous draft. We had we had that a restraint was without consent when it was accomplished by physical force, intimidation, or deception, or any means, including the acquiescence of the victim, if he is a child who has not yet reached his 16th birthday, or an incompetent person. Remember, there was a lot of discussion about what we meant by an incompetent person. Yeah, we meant really what we're talking about is mentally incompetent. But we didn't. There was some feeling, we didn't necessarily want to restrict it to mentally incompetent. What we're really concerned with is about capacity to consent. So what I've done, I've used the word incapable, who has not reached his 16th birthday, or who is otherwise incapable, and I've taken out incompetent altogether. Now, and then in my commentary, I state that the main purpose of the change here is to delete the reference to an incompetent person, which seemed to be troublesome because of its apparent restrictiveness. The words, quote, or who is otherwise incapable of giving consent, are intended to focus upon the issue of whether the person, because of mental incompetency or other disability, is unable to effectively consent to the taking or confinement. Then incapable is to be given its generally accepted meaning and should not require further definition. Then I set out Webster's definition, lacking in capacity, ability, or qualification, incompetent, unqualified, lacking legal qualification, disqualified, or ineligible. It seems to me that really runs the gamut. If they can't consent, they can't consent, and it would be it would come within our definition then. And then lawful custodian. Put in there so that we wouldn't have to restate that each time in the kidnapping that we're talking about, because before we said where the parent, guardian, or other person having lawful control or custody has not acquiesced in the movement. It would be without consent if he's under 16 or incompetent, that's what we said before. So here I've just used lawful custodian.
I wonder, what would you think? I'm having a little trouble reading it. Without consent means that the taking of confinement is accomplished by force, threat, or deception, or confinement is accomplished without the consent of a lawful guardian or custodian for one who has not reached his... pardon my interference, but I know what you say, but the second line from the bottom of that paragraph, giving consent, that, I think is probably grammatically correct, but without consent means that the taking or confinement is accomplished by force, threat, or deception. Beautiful. Or, then this next phrase is so long, and maybe it means, or in the case of a person who's otherwise incapable of giving consent, means that the taking or confinement is accomplished without the consent of his lawful custodian.
There'll be means in there again.
Maybe it means.
Yeah.
Did you see my...
Yeah.
I don't know that means helps it any, but that almost I had to go back and read what...
Yeah.
I think you're probably grammatically correct, but it reads a little harsh.
Yeah. In other words,
or maybe in parentheses or something.
Or after consent, before that, put means in there again.
Or in the case of a person who's not reached 16th birthday, who's otherwise incapable of giving consent, means... Of course, that doesn't really... I'm trying to parallel them. Without consent means, colon. Um,
parentheses. Do we do that at all? Do we ever use parentheses?
Well, not usually. It's not recommended. Some states use it quite a bit in their statutes. We don't ordinarily. one thing, it gets confused with brackets too, you know, I think is one of the problems with it. But,
well, why don't you, I hate to interfere with somebody else's handiwork. My suggestion.
Well, no, that's
but, well, no, but I mean, unless I have some clear thought on how to improve it, and I'm just, I don't know if it means does any good. Maybe an A means A, that taking or confinement is accomplished by force, threat, or deception, or B, in the case of a person who has not reached his 16th birthday or who is otherwise incapable of giving consent to taking confinement, I think that would help.
That'd be a way of doing it. Sure, we break it down into paragraphs.
Yeah, without consent means : A, if the taking confinement is accomplished by force, threat, or deception, or B, if in the case of a person who has not reached his 16th birthday or is otherwise incapable of giving consent, that the taking confinement is accomplished. So, yeah, I think that would help me.
Okay. That way. Yeah.
Lawful custodian.
I thought about putting the word or institution in there after person, but I got to thinking, well, in the case of a person who's been confined to an institution, say, or placed in the custody of the juvenile court or Hillcrest or where it happens to be, they're not given to the custody of the person anyway, they're given to the custody of the superintendent or a named person anyway. So if there were an interference with custody, it would be with the custody of the superintendent of Hillcrest or, you know, whoever it happened to be, rather than Hillcrest as an institution. So I didn't really think it was necessary.
I think you're right.
But
I was wondering why you said, are the person responsible by authority of the law? And then I figured that the Hillcrest girls and the Fairview Home girls, where they do have trouble like this, then that would be a person who's neither a parent, guardian, but would be another person responsible by authority of law.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then on relative, it's the same as we had before, except I've taken out...
You didn't take it out of the Corrupt Practices Act, did you?
No, I haven't touched the Corrupt Practices Act, and I hope I never have to.
Well, that's two of us. Well, no, I just noticed that it doesn't include custody.
No, it doesn't.
Which is fine, because you get into the cousins first and second, once removed.
It seems to me this ought to be broad enough to... and really what you're going to get into in these kind of cases anyway, Wally, you know this, it's going to be some kind of a rhubarb probably going on in the family. You've got a grandparent who doesn't like the way somebody's raising his kids, or...
We do need children in there, though, don't we? I mean, I grant you, the chances of a 16-year-old having a child are relatively remote, but on the other hand, the chances of one who is incapable because of insanity of having a child is possible.
Well, I'm not sure I followed you here. You need child in the definition of relative?
Well, let me see. Let me go back.
Because the only place we use that is with respect to somebody who is doing the taking or abducting or whatever happens to be.
only on the interference?
Yeah, and in other words, if you've got a child who's also a parent, then he's going to be under the definition of parent if he takes, entices, or keeps.
No, I see. I was thinking about the fact that you have a... You can't. The custodial interference only applies to children. It's not applied to the incapacitated.
Well, no, it could. No custodial.
Well, as far what I'm saying is, the exclusion of a relative only applies, apparently, the only place I found it whisking through here, and I don't remember it any other place, the only place a relative can cop out
does not get nailed is dealing with a 16-year-old or less, or a 15-year-old.
Yeah, and then he's not going to get nailed for second-degree kidnapping.
Yes, that's what I mean.
But he could get nailed under custodial interference.
Well, if I take my father for a ride, that's not a defense to it, is it?
If you take your father?
Mm-hmm. Under kidnapping the second degree. Now, if he takes me, it's a defense. No, that's not either. I'm not under 16. Were I under 16?
Yeah, it'd be a defense if you were under 16, and his only reason was to
assume. Well, as a matter of fact, it'd be a defense now, wouldn't it? Because a person commits a crime kidnapping second degree, if an intent to interfere substantially with another person's rights without legal consent, he takes me from one place to another. Now, it's a defense if the defendant, my father, is a relative to me. So he can take me where he wants, even in fact I'm 34.
No. That in itself wouldn't be enough. Because you got to have all three of these things under subsection 2 of section 2. You've got to have all three.
Oh, I see. You've got to have A first. I'm sorry. All right. But let's say I'm 16. I'm 15 then. I'm nitpicking, but for some reason, relative specifically excludes children. And usually a child is a relative. And what I'm saying is that apparently then it's a one-way street.
Well, in other words, you're saying that...
Let me contrive a fact situation that might be somewhat tortured. A 15-year-old, well, we know this, that if you're all right there. You have to be 16 before you do the defense of it. The guy out taking on the ride has to be under 16.
Yeah. So if you're a child and you're taking a relative of yours,
then that's not a defense.
No.
Well, I can't poke a hole in there. Well, for whatever consolation it is to you, I'll be ready to go back and try for 5. You want to add the one on coercion?
Well, I thought maybe we ought to talk about it, Wally. I wish we had some other guys here, but...
I just wonder how long we ought to continue this. It's not going to be much benefit to do this and then go Saturday and let Haas and the new Attorney General be he there, or the old Attorney General and Lynn let air on us. Session this morning, and I found out finally the reason
coercion, that we'd be remiss if we just wrote it off. And I've had a little bit of change of heart on that. With respect to assault, I thought, well, it may have been superfluous because we've got this coverage for theft by extortion under our theft statute that we drafted. You see, that only covers the question of where there's property involved. And if they unlawfully obtain property from another by coercion, then it's going to be theft by extortion. Or if they're attempting to obtain property, we'd have it covered, which is really what our extortion statute now is. Really, it amounts to an attempt, because you don't have to actually obtain anything to commit extortion in our present statute. So we'd have that covered as attempted theft by extortion, if that was their intent, even though they didn't get anything. But supposing that wasn't the intention of the defendant, that he wasn't trying to get property, he was trying to, as you say, force somebody to do something against their will, I don't think we've got it covered. we might have it covered from the standpoint, if you've got a kidnapping involved, this is your hypothetical, where you've got a kidnapping and that was the motive for the coercion, then you could charge the guy with kidnapping because what he did to the victim.
Yeah, but of course, the slicker way, the better operator does it by disconnecting the phone at the home, which is at worst a trespass and does damage to personal property, then tells, misinforms the president at the bank that I now have your children or your wife and children. You can call home if you want, but they won't answer, or some such thing. And he's never really committed any restraint at all. And but perhaps that's extortion.
Well, yeah, and well, or supposing you've got somebody who comes to you and says, well, Mr. Carson, you're House Majority Leader. You've got a lot of influence, and I want this bill passed. And if you know what's good for you, you're gonna see that it gets through, or something to happen to your children, or at home, something like this.
This it happened 2 days ago to Wayne Turner, as a matter of fact.
Was that right?
Yeah, he got several threatening phone calls to vote for the Steelhead bill, or something serious would happen to him.
But, you know, something like that, that's a bad actor.
Yeah.
He ought to be nailed.
And, it doesn't involve money in the sense of your hypothetical, or the one that actually happened, Turner's case, does not involve money.
No, it doesn't. And, so
it's a threat, it's perhaps an assault in our due bodily harm.
Yeah, you might get him under there. It's, I think we'd be on safer ground to have something specific in here about it, although I think really it more properly belongs, along with the kidnapping, than assault. But, now, see, we had that and it would cover a threat to cause physical injury to some person or cause damage to property, or engaged in other conduct constituting a crime, or accuse some person of a crime, or cause criminal charges to be instituted against him, expose a secret or publicize an asserted fact, tendency to subject some person to hatred, contempt, or ridicule, cause or continue a strike, boycott, or other collective action, except that such a threat shall not be deemed coercive when the act, etc., is for the benefit of the group for in whose interest the actor purports to act. This is all practically identical to the language we used in our theft by extortion draft, except there it was with the intent to obtain property.
What do you think? Do you want to draft one, or should we?
Well, we've got a section drafted that came with the assault section, which is consistent with our theft draft, and which, you know, if you just wanted to send it to the commission and let them consider it, at least if they don't want it, at least we can have it open for discussion. But I think that I was a little hasty in saying that we didn't need it.
To repeat again for my density, that is not a part of our assault thing now.
No, the way assault finally went in after the subcommittee deleted this from assault.
All right, let's run it back through.
We can put it back in as another section.
Tentatively.
The last section of kidnapping.
Interference, right.
And at least let them take a look at it. Now, this is, and Bob Thornton mentioned this, and he said, well, he had had cases come up where he felt the law was inadequate in this area, and he felt we shouldn't be too hasty in writing it off. And I think he was right.
Yeah. Well, let's put it in and trot it out, and let the boys get a shot at it.
And if they don't want it, well, at least we've done our duty, you know.
Okay.
Let them take a look at it.
Okay, now, do you want to get into the fun and games, or?
Well, gee, I don't know. I wanted to get into it, but gosh, it takes some pretty sweeping changes in the law, this thing, and I sure would hate to send that in to the commission without running it through the ringer here in the subcommittee.
Yeah. Well, my apologies. Let's not do it. I haven't even read it. It'd be an instruction for Wally, and we've got a lot more things to do.
Is judiciary...
checking? Thank you, sir.
Preliminary draft number one of bribery and corruption. Is that the one we're on?
I'll just call him and tell him I'm in 321.
Roger, do you want to pick this one?
This is Roger's draft, so we'll let him carry the ball on this.
Fire away.
Okay. Section one, page one, seven definitions of the words of art used in this article. And we can just briefly go over those. Benefit is defined as meaning any gain or advantage to the beneficiary or to a third person pursuant to the desire or consent of the beneficiary. I might note here, starting with number two, we have gone over this since it was printed, and are going to suggest some changes. Subsection two reads, pecuniary benefit is benefit in the form of money, property, commercial interest, or anything else of which the primary significance is economic gain. And we think it might be better to conform to the rest of the definitions. Pecuniary benefit means a benefit.
Just be a style change is all.
That's the style that's used in most of our drafting.
Yeah, right. And of course, means limits it and is more precise. And
more precise than it is?
Well,
I think you're quibbling.
Yeah.
Oh, you haven't seen nothing yet,
there,
baby.
I got to use the word cavilling.
We ran
across that today. Cavilling.
Cavilling.
I hadn't looked that up.
What does
cavilling? The idea is, I know.
How do you spell it?
Means to be a nitpicker.
Gosh, it's my own name, and I don't even know what it is.
And Roger and I suggested.
I think most of it, the legislative council usually uses means.
Yeah, right. And of course, the drafting manual prescribes means ordinarily. You don't have to use it necessarily, but is and means are pretty similar, I think. But
well, there'll be some other changes as we go along here in connection with the word means and includes. Three of these paragraphs use the words includes, and we decided includes tended to expand the meaning, where means tended to restrict it, and what we really meant was means and not includes. Beginning with paragraph three, we've made some substantial changes in that. You can see what we have there now. And the suggested change we made today was public servant includes any public officer or employee of government, comma, legislator, comma, judge, comma, any person, comma, accepting witnesses, comma, participating as an advisor, juror, consultant, or otherwise, in performing governmental functions, comma, and a person who has been elected or appointed to become a public servant, although not yet occupying that position. We changed the word designated to appointed only because we felt it was more commonly used in connection with elected or appointed designated.
Let me ask a question. What happens to a member of the bar?
What was the question?
What about a member of the bar?
Would a member of the bar be a public servant? Governmental functions.
Otherwise, in the performance of governmental functions.
Yeah, we've got governmental functions defined as meaning any legally authorized activity.
An officer of the court.
Yes. I think he would be. At least when you're talking about, for example, your board of bar governors and
a lawyer participating.
The lawyer, ordinary lawyer, is an officer of the court.
Yes, within taking the definition of an officer of the court, he would come under the definition of a public servant.
Well, then don't you run into a problem? Isn't he taking a bribe every time he takes a fee? With intent to gain, make economic gain.
Doesn't always work out that way.
Well, I think, though, that definition, as it's used in context of the bribery section,
I'm sure the court is trying to find a way out of it, but I think we ought to try to be a little more precise.
Yeah. Are there other people that are in a similar category?
Now, you excluded a witness because you're going to pick them up with suborning, perjury, and tampering with witnesses or whatever?
Well, no, there will be specific bribing witness statutes under obstruction of justice.
Which is a different article. It's a separate article.
Do you deem that more?
It's just that it's very difficult to consider witnesses as public servants.
Even though they might be performing a court function, what would be a governmental function?
Because ordinarily witnesses would be bribed even before they are sworn or have testified, at which time their legal position is nothing other than a citizen.
I think the definition is I'm reworking myself.
What's the model penal code say?
Well, they're
suppose the governor. Suppose the governor has a private citizen who he relies on as an advisor.
Yeah.
Somebody bribes the advisor, or somebody gives the advisor.
Well, it would appear under this definition, if he was acting as a consultant in performing governmental functions, he would be covered, even though he weren't
on the... Yeah, but he's working for no pay.
Right, even though he were not on the payroll.
Oh, yeah, I don't think this definition envisions that he has to be paid in order to be a public servant.
Well, the question in my mind is, do we really want to hold that individual? Is that what the statute is designed to get at?
Well, pay really isn't the key factor, though. Because we have so many public boards in Oregon.
First place, you have a lot of government...
we wouldn't want to exclude them.
Well, the type of consultant I'm talking about is... and I think this is probably true with any chief executive. He's probably got a group of people he relies on who are private citizens, and all of them may very well have special interests that they're being paid for. He recognizes this.
Well, you have many advisory committees named in the government that receive no pay.
That's right.
What about a lobbyist?
Like
a lobbyist is an advisor.
What does
the legislature often rely on the lobby for advice?
Well, for instance, the city of Salem has a number of advisory committees, traffic committees, and beauty committees, and all these things. I wonder if they accept a gift from...
Well, sometimes those committees are actually made up of people who it is recognized to have vested interest.
Well, one way we could tend to, in a way, what we call a clarifier restricted, is by expanding the definition of what a governmental function is. Because we've got the two definitions tied together. In other words, governmental function just refers you back to what a public servant is.
Why don't we go on and note this, that this is going to have to be worked, and maybe if we carefully screen its use at the other end on its application, we might be able to work that, get it a different direction.
Which I tend to think that you probably want to limit it to people that are actually getting compensated for the service.
Well, Lee, though, then you've got, God, you got the, look at all the public boards we have. The governor, say this, aren't there, how about the Highway Commission? Should someone be able to attempt to bribe them with impunity?
Tomorrow, I don't know. If we don't catch...
But on the other hand, you have a lot of boards and commissions that have people that are on there specifically
because the Governor's Committee on Workmen's Compensation.
Yeah. Are recognized. Well,
you've got,
they're paid...
Labor and Management.
They're paid lobbyists.
Well, let's go on to
I think after we go through some of these other sections, maybe some of these will clear up.
Well, on sub 4,
Excuse me, in the meantime, Roger, could we get a photocopy of your proposed definition or something so we can, so we can have it when we get back to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just
cranked that out.
Talked this out this morning.
Maybe when we get
possible
back to
changes.
It, we could all have the same thing, because you'll be talking off one.
It's really,
well,
it's primarily structural. I don't think it changes the meaning of anything.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just form and style more than anything else.
I'd raise a question on four.
We have changed includes to mean to means, because we felt includes was ambiguous in that government includes any branch subdivision agency of this state or locality. It might suggest that down there it was just part of something larger.
Well, I
we wanted to exclude the federal government.
Yeah, I understand that. I don't think you've included all local government in that definition. Home rule city, I don't think is part of the state.
How come you went this way?
Or any locality within it, I don't know, it's awfully...
Municipal government.
What?
How come you went this route instead of municipal,
municipal
or quasi-municipal
or
government? Such as school districts, sewer districts, water districts?
Well, the one I think you can say that those are all...
Well, this is intended to include it. It might not be clear. If you leave out this state, government means any branch, subdivision, or agency of any locality within this state. It says of this state or any locality within it, but that might not be.
Locality is not a very defined
locality
word.
Is the
and a home rule city, I don't think, is part of. It's, they're not a subdivision of state government.
No, that's true.
I don't know. I just think there's ways they define these. Might check with legislative council on this to get it all.
Well, we can revise that and try to make more clear exactly what it means.
For instance, on page 5, you'll see that under public servant, they're defining public servant, but it means a public officer employee of the state or any political subdivision thereof, which is the way we normally say it,
yeah.
I think, in Oregon.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to catch Lee's point, or any governmental instrumentality within the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, this is model penal code language, is where Roger got this definition of government.
Well, I think if you, my preference would be to go to the state or any political subdivision thereof, picks up the sewer districts and all of these.
Yeah.
And then adding the phrase, or any governmental instrumentality, catches the home rule cities and the other ones, at least I think it would.
Yeah, I don't know. There's, I mean, legislative council drafts these things all the time, and I think they've got language that has been handled by the courts in Oregon, and make no question about the inclusion of everybody and so on.
Well, I think we all know what we mean by for matter, trying to put it in a form that we're more used to. Going to five.
Well, our definition of five is somewhat tied to definition of three. And if we're going to make some changes in the definition of public servant, we'll probably have to make some changes in the definition of governmental function. Yeah.
Is a political party defined anywhere in our code?
Yeah. The only problem I have is here is gives the question, which I haven't got the answer to. But it's a question I have that goes through this whole subdivision. Is the one that's raised by somebody. In fact, is this all a matter of? I think parts certainly are clearly criminal jurisdiction, but part of it. Wondering whether it is applicable for criminal sanction, or is this something that should be in the Corrupt Practices Act, separate apart from the criminal code? When you get down to the bribery of a party official, you're talking about elections.
In
the state, you could bribe one. It wouldn't make any difference anyway. You'd make power.
You could buy up all the precinct committee when you wanted.
I'm giving to you.
The term is used in the section on page 23 on intimidation in public and political matters.
Well, now, you've tried in this draft, my understanding is that you've tried to stay away from the Corrupt Practices Act as such.
Yes.
The Corrupt Practices Act, I know, covers some of the conduct you're talking about in here, and I think it properly should be covered in here and not the Corrupt Practices Act, possibly.
Well,
maybe we ought to cover it all here. I don't know.
Of course, here,
of a really corrupt nature versus conduct which should be just regarded as violation of the election laws.
Is Section 5 or on page 23, Roger? Is that the only place you get into the reference to the party? Here, this is different. When you look at page 23, Section 5,
23.
This is purely, really, for the protection of the party officials. It's not his influence upon somebody else, it's harm, not bribing in a sense, it's intimidation.
Yeah.
That's almost like threatening an assault or battery.
Well, or coercion, you know, we talked about coercion in that
section
that we had in the kidnapping article.
Well, this section here is clearly in the Corrupt Practices Act today, about three or four different places.
It also encompasses economic harm, doesn't it?
Well, Wally, the question I really raise is I frankly feel that the kind of conduct that we're talking about here should be in this statute and taken out of the Corrupt Practices Act.
Yeah, on page 26.
We shouldn't even call it the Corrupt Practices Act. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about felonious conduct here, or certainly approaching a felony.
Yeah, Roger mentioned this in his commentary on page 26.
Yeah, I saw he had some.
Is there any problem with the definition of what a party official is?
What does "and or otherwise" encompass? Crimes?
Anything we forgot. Well, I suppose that there can be people operating in a political apparatus that would say we're not elected and we're not appointed, although offhand I can't think exactly what they would be.
Well, heaven forbid, but the SDS is non-leadership, for instance. They have no leaders elected because it's totally democratic, no representative.
And if they did a Portland State, we know who should be.
But they wouldn't be regarded as a party.
Well, they may be a political party.
Well, now this is a question.
Well, now that raises the question of just
well,
a
political
exactly
party
what
is
political
defined for purposes of the election laws and the election. Now, we want to follow that definition. I think we do, don't we? Or do we want to follow the case of somebody bribing a member of the SDS?
Well, I would doubt that. I think we're all right now. But and the SDS is a bad example, perhaps. But YAF or ADA or some other, not quite so.
Let me ask you this: how about defining party official? Means a person defined. I think it's probably defined in the election code.
Is it? Is it, you know?
No, I don't know. I doubt whether political
party
is such. I bet
you guys wish I had come to this
meeting. No, that's what I was saying. 162.
Oh, that's what we're supposed to do at these subcommittee meetings, is iron out some of these problems.
You ain't seen nothing yet. When are you to a full committee?
Wait till we get to the meet.
And everything, and they just rip you to shreds. I'm only sorry I didn't get to see John Burns get taken on in ours, which I understand was
Well, what is this, John Burns? I took a few lumps.
You got a little few lumps too? Sorry, I didn't mean to brought that up. Political party means an affiliation of electors representing a political party or organization which polled for its candidates for presidential electors at the last general election at least 20%. That just means major political parties, which means that somebody can be a political party that's less than 20%. My only point is, if you take away from SDS, let's take it to YAF or the United Republicans.
But the thing is, that statute, you know, defines, it has a minor political party in it, too.
Yeah.
But that is a statute, still has a statutory recognition. I mean, you go through steps to form a party.
Yes.
And are we talking about an informal organization?
Well, this is what I'm thinking. For instance, the United Republicans of Oregon, which was that rather conservative group that we had in 66, that claimed to be a Republican Party in Oregon. They were not a major political party, but they clearly could have qualified for a political party.
Well, don't you run in, let me ask you this, if we included the United Republicans, suppose they're really, they have some very specific purpose. They want to get a 1.5% on the ballot, or they want to get a bill to lease oil to the oil companies. Is there anything wrong with somebody bribing that? Are we getting into a free speech problem then?
Well, this, as I say, this definition of subparagraph 6 will only apply to section 5, which is intimidation of a party official. It doesn't come up in the bribery section. Only the public servants apply there.
I'd make the suggestion, in view of the open primary system in Oregon, that we eliminate party official.
We should do what?
Eliminate party official.
Well, in my opinion, it's going to be very difficult to come up with a comprehensive definition of political party.
I think you run into, if you get too broad, you're going to run into free speech problems. There is no, I mean, people have a right to pay somebody to go out and advocate a cause. I don't see that bribery of party officials in Oregon who have virtually no power.
The bribery sections will not apply to party officials under this draft. The only section that applies will be the intimidation.
Just intimidation, yeah.
Only for the protection of the party officials.
I don't see the threat.
But the thing I worry about is...
I move we delete it.
Yeah. Do you not get in some very interesting discussions about intimidating an SDS... If they are, that's probably a bad example. Unlawful harm, which is, Harl pointed out, economic loss.
Yeah, I think it defines it.
To any party official with the intent to influence his vote. For instance, you tell a kid, you better shape up or do something or we'll throw you out of school. Are you not then perhaps guilty of the crime of threatening an SDS party official with that economic harm, perhaps being canned, losing a scholarship, put it that way.
Let's say you have a lawyer that's a member of the Central Committee, and the primaries are over and the nominee dies, and the Central Committee is going to appoint. One of his clients call and say, gee, we wish you had appointed Joe Dokes. If you don't, then they're going to handle our business anymore. Would they be guilty of that?
There'd be an awful lot of people in the can. We're talking about felonies here, aren't we? Isn't all these statutes primarily designed to protect against corrupt behavior in the operation of government, not
most of these bribery statutes will be felonies. Some of the others will be misdemeanors.
Could not someone who is threatened with harm violently particularly have recourse other than naming an individual would certainly have a recourse
for assault?
Without relying on the fact that I am a party official.
Oh, yeah, I think so, sure.
Well, the reason I, for instance, a minor political party, major political party is defined in 248, and a minor political party is defined as an affiliation of electors representing a political party or organization which polled for any one of its candidates for any public office in the state, county, precinct, or other electoral board's nomination made at least the last general election 5%. Entire vote cast for a representative in Congress. And a file and a body of 1,000 electors. So
what other section in here besides possibly 5 deals with
That's the only section. But probably
I just think we're getting into...
It's pointed out in the commentary on 5 that perhaps that statute isn't needed at all, that a broad criminal coercion statute might cover exactly the same type of offense.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right.
Well, I can see intimidation of a public official. Because that goes right along with bribing a public official. I mean, there's not much difference.
This same coverage, for example, is provided in the New York Code under the coercion statute.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'd move to strike 6.
And then correct Section 5 to eliminate...
Well, when we get to Section 5, you'll perhaps feel that it won't be required at all.
Just kidding.
Yeah, let's wait till we get to 5. I just think...
Okay.
Yeah, we could...
Harold, what do you feel about canning party officials?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. We'll recommend to the full committee. When we go to a full committee, we'll show them what we did and they comment why.
We're flattering them anyway. So there's a problem.
We're deleting 6 in your definitions?
Yes. Any question with number 7 on harm?
I believe that if you delete number 6, you also may be able to delete number 7 because I believe, if depending on whether you keep section 5 or not.
Yeah.
One thing harms means loss, disadvantage, or injury, or anything so regarded by the person affected. Now, I can understand to some extent why that. Regarded by the person affected from the standpoint of intent on the person that's intimidating, but on the other side, it puts the guy who's accused in a hell of a spot because it's purely subjective on the part of the victim.
Yeah, but the fact would be, would it not? It'd still be a. Would it be reasonably? Would you make an objective or a subjective test in that reviewing class?
It's subjective, let's read it. Rest.
Under the definition, it would appear to be a subjective test, at least to some extent. Of course, the.
We could change it by reasonably regarded.
Now, that's important in what section?
Section 5.
We've been around and around on the. In fact,
page
23. Yeah. Why don't we start going through the sections and go back to the definition.
Okay.
Don't you think that will kind of...
Well, yeah, that's usually the problem.
That's what we've done every time.
Yeah, you just get on the definitions and they're in the abstract.
So you see how
they can't really... I certainly would have a problem with that because Harold comes over to me and he says, God damn, if you don't render me an opinion in my favor on this thing, I'm going to beat the tar out of you. I go haul Harold into the court and I say, well, he scared the living daylights out of me.
I've been intimidated.
Excuse my language. That's the way Harold usually talks to you.
The whole time. Well, let's go to bribery then. Page 6. All right.
Well, this is the basic bribery statute. A is the giving of a bride, and B is the taking of a bride. First commits a crime of bribery if he offers, confers, or agrees to confer any pecuniary benefit on a public servant upon an agreement or understanding that such public servant vote, opinion, judgment, action, decision, or exercise discretion in his official capacity will thereby influenced.
Where's the will?
In his official capacity, be thereby influenced.
I think you got a typo in that.
You have a will under B and you have no will under A.
Influence, it probably
yeah.
has to have a D. Influenced.
Will be on line, or the last line of paragraph B, A.
Thereby be.
Oh, I see. You've got it in B.
Right.
Will thereby, but you don't have it in A.
Yeah, it should be will be thereby influenced.
It should be past tense.
Or one way or the other.
Not past.
They're said future two different perfect ways. Will thereby be, and actually will be should be together.
Will be thereby influenced.
All right, then change the last one in B, move the B around so it will read the same way. We'll be there by influence.
Right.
B is taking a soliciting of a bribe. While a public servant, he solicits, accepts, or agrees to accept any pecuniary benefit. The rest of the language is the same. C establishes a defense. Defendant conferred or agreed to confer benefit as a result of conduct of the public servant constituting extortion or coercion. And D, in effect, takes away a defense. There is no defense to prosecution if the person sought to be influenced was not qualified to act in the desired way, whether because he had not assumed office, lacked jurisdiction, or any other reason.
Could we go back to C, Raj?
C is where I lean on you to buy me a new car. Is that as I, the public official, lean on you? Is that the defendant, the non-public servant, the one? It has to be one who is offering the bribe.
Yeah.
And in effect, I've committed extortion by
the public servant.
Saying if you want a decision on this case, you'll have to get me a new car. You get me a new car, and then you're charged with bribery. You can show defense by saying the public official demanded it.
Is that a standard defense?
Well, the reason for it is that the courts are generally construed the act of bribery to be a voluntary conferral induced by coercion.
I can just see I see that defense coming up rather frequently.
Well, this is one thing that really worries you about this whole area.
Yes,
you can
the
see
the
also that, the lobbyist that takes you out to dinner.
Wouldn't you as a prosecutor have to prove, one, that there's an agreement, or two, an understanding? Mm-hmm. The question of understanding is...
Yeah.
Significant. Mm. But there'd have to be some
quid pro quo.
Yeah, there'd have to be some voiced or at least understood deal.
Yeah, I think that's right. That would be an element to be pleaded and proved by the prosecution under this, that there was an agreement.
Of course, the thing, maybe I'm super sensitive in it being in the public eye, but one could be charged with bribery for a dinner with a lobbyist. They can never prove it. Assume they couldn't.
And the vote or the conduct must be influenced by the bribe.
Well, the vote or opinion, judgment, action, decision, or exercise of discretion would most readily show up in the legislature on the vote. But it could also show up.
Well, if you could prove the passage of the consideration in the agreement, you wouldn't have to prove any action was taken on it. All you have to do is.
Suppose you come in and you say, now, Mr. Haas, isn't it true that Ken Rinke bought your dinner on such and such a date and asked you to vote for House Bill 325? Isn't it a fact you voted for that bill?
Well, I don't think that this draft would cause any problems.
Prosecution arrest.
It wouldn't exist under our present statutes.
No.
Really, it's no broader than our bribery statutes now.
But that assumes that we're all happy with our present statutes.
Yeah, but I don't know of any legislators who have been accused of bribery receiving for going out to dinner with a lobbyist, do you?
Yeah, but, no. Not yet.
Well, I think there's no question.
I think we
should re-examine everything. There are a lot of things on there are laws today that I don't think abide by our morality, but...
Don, after our work on the sex offenses of some weeks ago, and after the action of the legislature in the waning days passed that famous fondling bill, you heard about that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Maybe we should look at everything. Well, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't look at everything, and I'm certainly not suggesting that everything we've got, if it were ideal, then there wouldn't be a need for this commission.
There's very few, in any of this area, just like when we got in the sex area, there's very few of the laws. If you throw discretion to the winds, that anybody couldn't be prosecuted, maybe not convicted under.
The problem is, what we're really a little bit worried about is the pecuniary benefit.
Well,
because we all here's the guy who take this statute about this after the fact statute, rewarding past official misconduct. Suppose somebody sends me a bottle of whiskey at Christmas and says, "Thanks a lot for voting for my bill."
Gives you a signing die party or
something. Is there
maybe
some way of putting a pecuniary, some element of substantial in
the Well, of course, the rewarding past official misconduct only applies if it's in consideration for a violation of duty. In other words, on voting on a bill, it wouldn't be a violation of the official duty.
Of course, pecuniary benefit's pretty substantial.
Well, I don't understand. This is what bothers me. Pardon me. Excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, it says, in the form of money, property, commercial interests, or anything else of which the primary significance is, economic gain.
Well, I'd hate to get into the how much is too much bit. That's the only bad thing about saying substantial. We've used it in other parts of the
Maybe substantial. I don't know. But it raises a problem. I mean, you go further, somebody takes you on a fishing trip.
Of course, one of the things is that I think we're all being legislators, we tend to look at only the end of our nose, and we're looking at a rather unique system where perhaps, I'm not recommending this, but let's take it over into now to the Attorney General's position. And I can see a difference. Maybe you can now that you've been in the Attorney General's office, but I'd hate to say, for instance, circuit judges, by gad, they ought to be tough. They shouldn't be going out, they shouldn't be going out getting benefit, and, in my view, getting discounts and this sort of stuff, pecuniary benefit of any kind. I don't want a judge getting any break.
Well, yeah, I agree with that, Wally. The only thing is, and I think that's somewhat implicit in the Code of Ethics, the Judicial Code of Ethics.
Yes, that's true.
But
that's true.
I think the operating politician has a little bit of a difficult time if he... I don't really think that people are are too concerned over the, you know, when Governor McCall gets a free ride to somewhere, it's or this type of thing. I mean, he has these kind of problems, and certainly, let's don't point a finger at any individual, but I'm sure that look at any of our past governors, they probably had some kind of fund to help them travel. Because basically the taxpayers don't pay them enough money. Take Packwood slush fund.
No, you.
No, but I mean, here's something that's out in the open and everything else.
Well, of course, these kind of problems, I think, is what they were trying to get at here with by using pecuniary benefit rather than just benefit. Now, now the bribery section talks in terms of a pecuniary benefit, which would get you away from, you know, log rollings, or boat trading. And
does it really, though?
Kind of thing. I mean, that's at least that's what the what they're trying to do here by.
Yeah, but that's setting a standard of conduct that I don't think really our society quite expects.
Well, yeah, but if you take pecuniary in the sense it means only cash, money, which is the definition here in the dictionary, consisting of money, exacted or given in money, entailing a money penalty, relating to money, monetary.
Yeah,
no sweat. Your bottle of booze and your trip, all these things are out in the open. The question I'll now ask, though, is do we really mean pecuniary? Are we saying that if somebody is sufficiently...
Oh, suppose somebody gives me a yacht, I mean...
Well, no, but we've defined pecuniary benefit in the form of money, property, commercial interests, or anything else.
So you've defined pecuniary out of benefit. You defined the money out of benefit. Haven't you?
Well, rather, maybe sure, we talked about the word substantial. How about significant?
For instance, let's suppose, let's take vote trade. Let's say that I'm a president or an officer of a commercial bank, of a non big bank, little bank, and you have a bill. Well, it's to my interest to see that the savings loans don't get small loan privileges. All right, now I trade a vote. I trade my vote on making Steelhead a game fish in exchange for your vote to vote no on opening up the deal. Now that's sure, I'm just picking sheer vote trade. But that vote I've picked up on your vote against the savings loans certainly would come to my benefit if I am in fact a shareholder and stockholder in a small commercial bank. The result being that perhaps I've taken it one step away, but I'd say very clearly that's pecuniary or economic benefit, although it's just sheer vote trading in the good old congressional sense. But my question, I don't mean to be belaboring the point, is how broad, to me, pecuniary benefit, although you have attempted here to define it meaning money, property, commercial interest, or anything else.
It's defined to mean, actually the key word is primary significance is economic gain. It's meant to mean more than money.
Yeah.
Because that unduly restricted.
I agree.
Johnson said a yacht, certainly a $10,000 yacht is $10,000.
Yeah. The other question I raised about this thing is what do you do about campaign contributions? Now there is a provision in the Corrupt Practices Act that you which specifically where the contribution is for in return for some promise. I mean, it's illegal to make any kind of promise for a contribution. But, does this statute also include? Because that's certainly to my pecuniary benefit.
Don't we have to? We run into birthday gifts, Christmas gifts, anniversary gifts, the whole bag, unless we rely heavily upon the statement upon an agreement and understanding. In other words, if I don't say anything, then I can be showered with gifts by everybody, money, property, whatever, unless there's a promise or an understanding on my part that I will be influenced thereby, then you have, it takes my action as well as the donor. I'm frightened by your example of Harl, though, is that some jury could say, well, how'd you vote on 325 and slam the door on you? But I think that's the key rather than the benefit. Because if we start nitpicking benefit, I think we're in real trouble.
Well, yeah, and I sure think that this definition is preferable to what we have in our present statute, because 162.220 talks in terms of any gift, gratuity, valuable consideration, or thing, whatever. Then it goes on to prescribe intimidation and whatnot, too. Same way acceptance of acceptance by officer of gratuity corruptly accepts or receives any gift, gratuity, valuable consideration, or thing, whatever. And the model penal code felt that was too broad. That kind of
thing. Well, let me put